Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we are going through the Federalist Papers, kind of exposing everything that Hamilton was trying to do to set the stage for the judiciary to start running away with the control over the federal government. The outcome was that they literally subverted our Constitution as well as converted our form of government into a judiciary form of government. And so we were kind of wrapping up. Welcome back, Sean.
Good to be here, sir. Thank you.
No problem. And so I wanted to go back because I brought up a point, and I think that what ended up happening was we completely ran out of time, and I asked you a question, and I think, correct me if I'm wrong, either you weren't paying attention or actually probably more of I framed the question where you just said, yep, okay, or whatever. But I would blend to your memory on what ended up happening. And so as we ran out of time yesterday, we were talking about an issue, and I think I might have used the Whiskey Rebellion as an example. And so I think after the fact, we started discussing it, and I think you pointed out that that wasn't a very good example. And you're absolutely right, it wasn't a good example, but bottom line is the way the Constitution was designed. So actually, instead of me answering the question, why don't you revisit it to kind of help frame this? So go ahead.
Well, I think we were discussing the that Washington didn't go to the Supreme Court, or the Supreme Court didn't have any authority over.
Yeah, that was after the fact. That was after the fact. I was mentioning what the process in the Constitution is, that the Congress is to call forth the militia, that the judiciary has no role in this. And I used the Whiskey Rebellion as the example where Congress went out to call forth the militia. But I don't think that was actually discussed. I think what ended up happening is I asked you, and we ended up discussing it afterwards, where you pointed out that really, you started providing the clarity. So you're right that what ended up happening with the Whiskey Rebellion was how Congress decided not to follow the Constitution after Washington pushed back and said, I am not ready to do this. And so what Congress ended up doing was they created an act. And they created a one-time act. And as a matter of fact, this act was the portal for executive, what do you want to call it? Taking executive military action without going to Congress. Because what they ended up doing was they were ready to, and as a matter of fact, they were calling forth, that was out there, they were going to call forth the militia. Nothing happens quickly, but Washington had already kind of expressed within his cabinet, and who was in his cabinet? Well, Jefferson at that time in 92, as well as Hamilton. And so Washington really did not want to exercise the militia. He did not want to command forces to go out and, arrest and or do something to American citizens. He really didn't want to do it. And so as Congress was, getting ready to promulgate, or they'd probably already maybe offered the promulgation, I don't think it actually went out, but they were going to execute their mission to call forth the militia to basically execute the laws of the Union and hand the militia over to the president as the commander-in-chief to go execute the laws. Well, again, Washington was a rub, and in a big way, let me just say this. I'll say this as often as I possibly can. Washington was an army man. Washington's focus was strictly on the United States militia and actually the Department of Defense. I don't think that because he was really quiet during the Constitutional Convention. And so he already posed this, you know, anti-will upon Congress because Congress are the sovereigns. But what ended up happening, because there was such admiration and respect for Washington, he commanded his presence and their respect for him commanded Congress to do things that they shouldn't have done because the Constitution was kind of clearly debated in the process, in the notes, and in the ratification debates that Congress would do this, that Congress was the sovereigns. Well, when you have a bigger-than-life and a unanimously chosen president of the United States, it becomes, you know, this man can become a larger-than-life force. And we've seen this in our history, where we've actually had presidents become larger-than-life forces. Abraham Lincoln was another one who, you know, because of his position and because of, I will just say, those people that he recruited in developing or actually setting up his mercenary army, he was able to amass power pretty quickly to where, you know, when Taney told him, hey, you can't do this. The Constitution doesn't allow you to do this. I don't know if he actually put his finger in his chest, but I could just see this because Lincoln was a much taller and bigger man than Taney. I'm sure he just kind of bent over and put his finger in his chest and I'd like to see you enforce that. But Washington, some of the things that Washington didn't do under the Constitution that he was charged to do, and Congress was charged to do it, and the reason Congress didn't establish the Navy is because Washington's focus was on the Army. They didn't commit to creating the Navy until John Adams got into office. The entire Continental Navy had been disbanded, and Rhode Island had its own little, you know, fleet of ships or whatever states that had the ships. They didn't coalesce them, and the ships were not to be. I should say the state militia naval force was not to be a militia force. Congress was to establish a Navy and maintain a Navy. Didn't happen. Didn't happen until Adams got in because Washington was focused on the militia and all of these other little things that were actually pretty big for him because he was dealing with a lot of the hostilities from Britain still, you know, and they were still forming the government. It took a little while. I mean, you know, they everything they did, they built from scratch. So I'm not necessarily defending, but I will say this, that when Washington decided he was not going to execute the laws of the Union, he wanted to give them time. Congress ended up creating an act, and they don't have the power in the Constitution to create a law and or an act to bypass them, to allow them to do this. And so, in other words, they literally, it requires an amendment because it is clear Congress has the power to call forth the militia. By them to abjugate that responsibility, to allow the executive to do it today or even back then, it literally would have required to do it right, it would have required to do an amendment. But because of Washington and who he was, nobody questioned this little infraction or this little, what do you want to call it, the avoiding of doing what they were supposed to do. Because they didn't want to make the president look bad and say, hey, we're calling forth the militia, he's not doing his job. Causing that would be an awkward situation. So what they did, there's no doubt in my mind Hamilton was involved in this, that Hamilton included, because by this point in time, we kind of covered this already, that by 1792, Hamilton had corrupted and had basically by the Assumption Act started creating a corrupt affluence amongst Congress, to where Congress now was able to throw money out to the states and corrupt them. And by the time they got to the bank, Congress literally put aside what they were supposed to be doing, as Madison told them, you have to do this, you have to do this. And they pretty much swallowed the Kool-Aid from Hamilton that implied powers exist, that they can imply that they can do it, which is one of the reasons why they created this abjugation that required, I think you read it, so why don't you go ahead, because I will paraphrase it and not be as accurate as what you had yesterday, because the language was specific that I think he had to go to the judiciary, the Supreme Court, or Chief Justice, or what have you. So what does it say?
He actually had Justice Wilson do it, who was on circuit, but I'll read it. The Militia Act of 1792 mandated that before the president could call forth state militias to suppress an insurrection obstructing federal law, he needed a formal certification from either an associate justice of the Supreme Court or a federal district judge. This certification had confirmed that the rebellion was so powerful that it could not be suppressed by ordinary judicial proceedings or U.S. marshals. President Washington presented evidence of the violence and lawlessness in western Pennsylvania to Justice Wilson, who was circuit riding in Philadelphia at the time. Wilson did not act as a mere formality. Historical records show he made evidentiary demands and carefully reviewed the documentation. On August 4, 1794, after determining the evidence met the legal threshold, Wilson issued the required certification, stating that a state of rebellion existed that was beyond the control of civil authorities.
Okay.
Wilson's action established crucial early precedent for the separation of powers and demonstrated the president's power to use military force domestically, but not absolute, but subject to judicial check.
And that's all blah, 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 editorializing.
Right,
Okay, so blah, blah, blah. Okay, so actually, there are huge problems with this, because this is where this assumption that the judiciary was active, like the judiciary would be taking checks on, you know, violations of the law, like they were actually out there like cops, that the judiciary would be involved in suppressing, because you actually read that, where if the judiciary couldn't control it any further, and the judiciary has no role in that period. They don't have that constitutional role or responsibility to have an active role in enforcing the law. That right there was an add-in that Hamilton, working probably with who he was working with over in Congress, in creating the bill to make the president happy, and everybody said, okay, this bill is what's going to make the president happy, and because the creature is that devious. Madison and Jefferson realized how devious this guy was, which is one of the reasons why in 1793, and we're going to get into this much later, after the ratification debates, and we start talking about these early things in Congress, I'm going to go through and we're going to read just a few highlights out of the congressional record of some of the assertions that were levied upon, or the evidence and assertions and charges that were put upon Hamilton. And how Congress just decided not to hold them accountable. They didn't provide any evidence otherwise. They just weren't willing to hold this man accountable because he was doing some great things for them. They were loving it. So the language that was in there, and nobody's questioning this. That's the whole problem. How did we get to these editorializing summaries of the perversion of the law when everybody had just completely embraced that the judiciary could be active to do that? These Federalist Papers right here. These documents right here are the poisonous pill that, and who was the author of this? Hamilton. Hamilton, by hook or crook, you find Hamilton close and directly involved in almost every single step of the way of creating this omnipotent judiciary. So, granted, my point with the what should have happened and what did happen and what the Constitution demanded are obviously three completely different things. That what ended up happening was there was a huge placating, and there was probably a lot of political theatrics out of Hamilton in getting people to just go along with bringing the judiciary into this. Because, as I pointed out, in Western Pennsylvania, I'm absolutely surprised that there weren't First Amendment petitions, you know, calling out the unfairness of this tax, that the larger distilleries were getting away with paying a lesser tax than them. That charge right there would have actually put a pause on the tax itself because it violated the Constitution's uniformity clause. I don't know why, at least there's no documentation or record of any of this. And I don't know, maybe it could have been expunged. We do see that the 13th Amendment, which was ratified in 1812, not the Lincoln 13th Amendment, but the Congressional 13th Amendment about the nobility clause, about basically making sure that no person, no lawyer, can be a part of the bar and actually be a U.S. citizen. That actually was ratified. That amendment exists and sits in state records as a legitimate amendment numbered with other amendments numbered after it in Wyoming, and I've been told Colorado and many of the Western states as they were developing, they created compiled laws of the Union. And that original 13th Amendment was documented in those books as a part of the Constitution and its amendments. How did all this happen? How did these things get expunged? Well, I think that it comes to the craft of law, the craft of lawyers, the craft of jurists. And, you know, somebody come along and say, hey, we need to publish new ones. And guess what? They didn't include them. When they said, oh, you know what, we need to go and put a contract out so we have everything up to date. And lo and behold, the law books and the records and so forth were all, you know, cleansed where these things were expunged. I have no idea how it happened, but they didn't do as thorough of a job as they wanted to do. And I will say this, it always tips the hand, especially in a land of liberty where people would basically start questioning things if they started burning records and burning documents, saying, we got to get rid of these things. And, I mean, Britain kind of helped out in 1812 I think it was 1812 when they burnt D.C. So they got rid of a lot of records, and fortunately, the ratification debates were still out there. Each state still maintained their own copies, so they were able to reassemble a lot of the stuff. But anyway, I digress. The point is that what should have happened and what actually ended up happening because of Washington, and there's a guy by the name of Michael McKibbins. He runs Leader.com and other things, and he has documentation on Hamilton and Washington as spies. Now, Hamilton, I can see, he walks like a duck, he quacks like a duck. I mean, he looks like a duck. Hamilton looked, and as far as I'm concerned, he fits everything that I would classify as a spy. Washington, no. I don't see that. I can't see Washington being that guy. As a matter of fact, his farewell address, almost most of the things he did, I think he did just because he was ignorant. He just didn't understand those things. What he wanted to do versus what he should have done may be two different things, and what he ended up doing may be actually three different things in different circumstances. But I don't see, and so there's a lot of people that spend a lot of time grinding axes regarding our founders. I'm on board with Hamilton. I'm not on board with anybody else. There may be other people that, you know, lost their scruples here, lost their scruples there. But one thing I will say that would have been, as far as I look at it, the one thing that would have really changed had anybody going into their deathbed basically decried, hey, it was all a lie. We weren't, you know, we didn't feel and we didn't experience the divine hand of providence in creating that Constitution. That would have been something big. Where, you know, there was, and if it would have been one, it may have been an outlier, but if there were a few of these people that felt like, you know, this was a huge conspiracy, and that never happened, and it didn't happen because these guys were actually good men. They were righteous men. What ended up happening was they started losing their scruples when they started recognizing the power that comes from money. And being able to use money to influence people, and money that's not even theirs, and be able to do things with that money, again, that's not theirs. So anyway, any final comments or other points you want to bring up before we dive into the Federalists?
No, sir. Ready to go.
All right. All right, so we're on the seventh paragraph of the 80th Federalist Paper. And so this starts off with the fourth point rests on. So let's go ahead and dive into, and interestingly enough, you know, the third point just above, which is a very short paragraph, still less needs to be said in regard to the third point. Controversies between the nation and its members or citizens can only be properly referred to the national tribunals. Any other plan would be contrary to reason, to precedence, and to decorum. Well, the 11th Amendment actually canceled that out. There was a lot of problems with the jurisdiction over those types of cases. So that went out sideways. But anyway, let's go ahead and pick up the seventh paragraph.
Number seven, the fourth point rests on this plain proposition that the piece of the whole ought not to be left at the disposal of a part. The Union will undoubtedly be answerable to foreign powers for the conduct of its members, and their responsibility for an injury ought ever to be accompanied with the faculty of preventing it. As a denial or perversion of justice by the sentences of the court, as well as any other manner, is with reason classed among the just causes of war, it will follow that the federal judiciary ought to have cognizance of all causes in which the citizens of other countries are concerned. This is not less essential to the preservation of the public faith than to the security of public tranquility. A distinction may perhaps be imagined between cases arising upon treaties and the laws of nations, and those which may stand merely on the footing of municipal law. The former kind may be supposed proper for the federal jurisdiction, the latter for that of the states. But it is at least problematical whether an unjust sentence against a foreigner, where the subject of controversy was wholly relative to the lex loci, would not, if unredressed, be an aggression upon his sovereign, as well as one which violated the stipulations of a treaty or the general laws of nations. And a still greater objection to the distinction would result from the immense difficulty, if not impossibility, of a practical discrimination between the cases of one complexion and those of the other. So great a proportion of the cases in which foreigners are parties involve national questions that it is by far most safe and most expedient to refer all those in which they are concerned to the national tribunals.
So did you see anything that he kind of expanded judicial roles and responsibility, federal judicial roles and responsibilities in this fourth point? Anything?
Not really. I mean,
okay, that's fine. What I'll point out is towards the very top, the bulk of the first half of this paragraph, let me read this. The Union will undoubtedly be unanswerable to foreign powers, the Union being the states themselves, for the conduct of its members, and the responsibility for an injury ought ever to be accompanied with the faculty of preventing it. As the denial or perversion of justice by the sentence of courts, and we're going into, I'll redo this when we come back, because he ties the judiciary to a very specific role and responsibility that, again, is given to Congress. And it starts blurring the lines of who really has roles and responsibilities. So we'll be right back after this short promo. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so let me finish this up, because like I said, this is really subtle. And he says, as a denial or perversion of justice, in other words, this is a huge requirement for justice to be served in all cases, that it can't be done by anything other than the courts. At least one would conclude that, because, oh, that's justice comes from the courts. Perversion of justice by the sentences of courts, as well as in any other manner, is with reason classed among the just cause of war. It will follow that the federal judiciary ought to have cognizance of all causes in which the citizens of other countries are concerned. What's cognizance mean?
They should be mindful of it. They should know about it.
Yeah, they should be. It's almost not necessarily controlling, but they should be on top of it, right? They should be overseeing or at least observing in case of necessity of stepping in, that type of thing. So do you see what he's saying here? That in causes which affect citizens of other countries, that the justices need to be involved. Now, let me ask you this. How does war affect citizens of other countries?
It kills them.
Ah, so in other words, to have cognizance of all causes in which the citizens of other countries are concerned. So what do you think he's saying here? That the federal judiciary ought to have cognizance of all causes. So in other words, where is he basically laying this role out in just the perfunctory power only granted to Congress to declare war? What is he now saying? That Congress doesn't actually have that kind of power. That the cognizance ought to be with the federal courts. Do you see what he's saying here?
I see the point you're making, okay. But I'm not sure if that would relate to war with another country.
Okay.
Because that would be between the governments, not the individual
persons. So what it does is it basically creates a direct connection of the courts to be involved in those types of things. It only takes an ambitious person to say, well, the Federalist Papers say this, and obviously you cannot not affect citizens of other countries by declaring war, and where the federal courts might actually step in and say, you know what, we find this war worthy or not worthy, or involving themselves in basically overreaching in Congress's power. Now, remember, one of the things, and maybe this is probably a really good way to make this connection, because I don't think I've said this in a long time. One of the most sacred things that the framers safeguarded was the right of a trial by jury. And it was so important that each state innovated to make it better for themselves in changing even Blackstone's layout of a trial by jury to ensure that the individual rights in a trial would be protected by a jury of their peers so that truly justice would be served, because the foundation of this sacredness is that it is far better for a guilty man to go free than it is for an innocent man to go to jail. And so when we look at the case of the courts itself, and we look at the legislative body, we actually see that the legislature, being the highest court, is a court of a jury. The jury is the representatives of the people, where they have the ultimate say to determine things because the people have empowered them to do so. When we really look at the impeachment process involves all of Congress. In other words, the first jury of the people will sit and determine whether their charges need to be levied or not. And if an indictment of impeachment moves forward, in other words, the House of Representatives functions as a grand jury in determining whether an indictment and charge should move forward into the Senate, where the president be tried by another jury of the representatives of the states. So in other words, there's like a dual, when you look at the way they set up impeachment, it's, you know, not this, you know, this little thing. It's a huge, elaborate thing of two trials by jury. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
And so this idea, and one of the reasons why, and if nobody's read this, you'd probably be worth your while to go and read John Adams' A Republic. Because this was the paper that he wrote that literally laid out why our form of government needed to be a Republican form of government. Because of that, because the power would be in the hands of the people's representatives instead of being in the hands of an oligarchy like a judiciary, or in the hands of a tyrant like an executive. That the safest, the most just, and so forth. It's a very good read, and this is where, you know, the saying came from John Adams, that we are in a constitutional republic, the law is our king, and our representatives are, and I'm paraphrasing here, that are technically, when you look at our representatives, they're our jury to determine what laws would be necessary or what laws need to be expunged. And so this framework of this Republican form of government, you know, created and vested all of the power in Congress. Very little power was placed, and I've mentioned this, the president does have negative powers over law. I don't like the fact that he can't kill a law completely by calling it unconstitutional. He should be able to do that. The judiciary has no negative powers or positive powers over law or taxation. And the president has no powers over taxation. But when we go through and listen to the ratification debates, these men are literally saying, hey, look, these guys are the most powerful. One of the challenges that some of the anti-federalists had was the fact that the state legislature being omnipotent and the federal government being omnipotent, they couldn't understand how two omnipotent legislative bodies could coexist, because they couldn't see like the forest through the trees, or the differences of one wood grove to another wood grove of oak and a wood grove of pines, where, you know, there are distinct differences between their focus, their jurisdiction, and so forth and so on. They just thought that, and they had this in their mind, the anti-federalists, and I think it was really more of their ploy than it was of a logical argument, that with legislative bodies, general powers are delegated. However, the Federalists killed that argument of the Anti-Federalists by showing that no, they are being given very specific powers. If it's not delegated, they can't do it. And even though the same Anti-Federalists kept on getting up and saying, look, they're going to be able to do these things, you know, that they don't have the power to do. And then Federalists would stand up and go, that's something they can't meddle with because it's not enumerated. I mean, it got kind of pedestrian or very redundant by going back and forth in that way. But it seemed like they didn't have any other really good arguments other than to basically fearmonger and try to get everybody to be afraid that general powers were being given when that wasn't the case. And so, anyway, as I see this, to me, all of these things really help galvanize, you know, even the simplest minds that were in this convention recognized that this was well beyond them. And even the most intelligent minds had the same awe, where they recognized these inspirations and the final product and the outcome being well beyond what they fathomed and grasped. And so, to me, if we were actually functioning the way we're supposed to be functioning under the Constitution, America would be so much different. And as a matter of fact, the UN wouldn't exist. I honestly think that we would have moved into a stage of, you know, peace, world peace. You know, like Miss America, the beauty. I want world peace. We would have had it. It wouldn't have been just some, you know, pie in the sky hyperbole. It would have actually been actualized, because I believe all people. Most all people, you know, you may be a part of a faith, you may be part of an ideology, but deep down, even communists want to choose what they want to eat for dinner, want to choose what their profession's going to be. They want to choose, you know, their whole life is forced to do everything that they're told to do. Well, and to the Nitinoy, they may get to choose their dinner, but they want to be able to have more freedom and more liberty. That is innate in the spirit of man. And it causes us the desire for freedom, the desire of liberty. And so that's why I say I believe every communist exhibits that desire, that innate desire of liberty. Because when they drive their car out into town and they're, you know, going shopping or what have you, do they leave the keys in their car unlocked? Because no, that's their property. And communists aren't supposed to have property. But that's theirs, and they don't want somebody to take it. And so they lock it up. That's why they have locks on their doors in you know, communist countries as well. They want to keep their stuff. And so how well are they embracing communism to that fundamental level? They're not, because they do have that innate desire of owning property and having liberty and having and possessing rights and so forth. They want rights. And so they've been placated with these things and those things as, oh, we're giving you these rights. But it's nothing like what we have. Anyway, I'm pretty soaked swimming in this rat hole, so let me keep going. I see what Hamilton is doing is he's kind of creating this anything and everything that comes up, he is tagging the judiciary.
Yeah.
Anything and everything. He's saying, you know, they ought to have cognizance over this. It's not in the Constitution. You would have thought that even this language right here in the ratification debates, if this language was put out in front of people, they would have stopped everybody. It would have just caused maybe not panic, but it would have caused, you know, a uprising even amongst the Federalists to say, hold on, what did you just say? Right. Anyway.
Yeah, it sounds like kind of like the argument that's going on today about the immigration issues, where the leftists want every single person who came into the country illegally to have due process the same as an American citizen.
Right.
And it's just ridiculous.
Well, so only citizens have rights that are afforded by the country. Only the citizens have those rights. What they're basically saying is America should be the government of the world so that we could apply due process and provide voting and access for everybody. In other words, we shouldn't have boundaries. We should actually be the global nation.
Because in that case, then every violation of rights afforded to people under the Constitution in the American military should be there quelling that insurrection, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so back to Hamilton. Let's go ahead and dive into the eighth paragraph. And let's see if there's another obscure, oblique, reaching to connect something of the judiciary to something else that doesn't belong to them. Go ahead.
Number eight, the power of determining causes between two states, between one state and the citizens of another, and between the citizens of different states, is perhaps not less essential to the peace of the Union than that which had just been examined, or been just examined. History gives us a hard picture of the dissensions and private wars which distracted and desolated Germany prior to the institution of the Imperial Chamber by Maximilian towards the close of the 15th century, and informs us at the same time of the vast influence of that institution in appeasing the disorders and establishing the tranquility of the empire. This is the court invested with authority to decide finally all differences among the members of the Germanic body.
Okay, kind of a history lesson of how another nation utilized, the justice system, overcoming, obviously, he points out the tyranny or the hordes of war and so forth. So let's do nine. Go ahead.
Number nine, a method of terminating territorial disputes between states under the authority of the federal head was not unattended to, even in the imperfect system by which they have been hitherto held together. But there are many other sources besides interfering claims of boundary from which bickerings and animosities may spring up among the members of the Union. To some of these we have been witnesses in the course of our past experience. It will readily be conjectured that I allude to the fraudulent laws which have been passed in too many of the states. And though the proposed Constitution establishes particular guards against the repetition of those instances which have heretofore made their appearance, yet it is warrantable to apprehend that the spirit which produced them will assume new shapes that could not be foreseen nor specifically provided against. Whatever practices may have a tendency to disturb the harmony between the states are proper objects of federal superintendence and control.
So this is still kind of ambiguous. And there is a role within the judiciary, like the commerce and or boundary disputes, navigation, that does exist. But again, for the court to get involved, the court's passive. It just sits there. And all sorts of things are happening. And, these states are bickering over the land and so forth. The court's job is not to stand up and step in and say, we need to have a case on this and we need to judge what needs to happen here. They can't do that. What has to happen is either both or one state, and nine times out of ten, this is what I've learned, is whoever controls the decorum, the pace, and everything else regarding the case, so that it is behoove of any and either state to get a case filed, because it gives them, they become the plaintiff, and they become they have the ability to drive the schedule and so forth. So the case would have to then go to a federal district court, because it is a case between two states, if it arises under the Constitution. In other words, if there's a bickering, and I'll give you a case in point. If California had a bunch of steel mills, like Pennsylvania, And those steel mills were basically pumping black soot, you know, from coal burning and everything else that they were doing, like we've seen out of the eastern states of the, you know, these big, huge chimneys of black plumes of smoke. And that was going, you know, eastward because of prevailing winds, and it was just suffocating the poor people in Nevada. And, you know, having ill effects on the people of Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, you know, as things just kept on prevailing, that more and more states started to step in and say, hey, you can't do this, California. And they issued a charge and basically sought in a federal court relief from California being able to, you know, continue to pollute their air. Does the federal government have jurisdiction over that?
I would think so.
Does it arise under the Constitution?
No.
No. So the federal court can't have jurisdiction because it has to arise under the Constitution. So where would the first court be? Well, the first court is not the court itself. The first court is the legislature. This is where Congress would need to go and say, you know what, we need to make this the environment. We need to create laws. We need to have the ability to regulate, you know, behavior that is having an ill effect on others. And I would have bet you dollars to donuts had Congress came out with an amendment to be able to create the Environmental Protection Agency and said, you know, you need the federal government to regulate because, you know, sometimes states aren't going to behave properly and blah, 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 blah. And I bet you anything that the states would have actually, back in the 60s and 70s, the people of the states and the state legislatures would have basically granted that amendment to be ratified. So why didn't they do it? Because then all of a sudden it might start highlighting all of the other things that they've assumed from the very beginning. Well, if we actually act like we were doing something legitimately now, then it might highlight the fact that we didn't do things legitimately before. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
And so, you know, what they went down this path of assuming powers, they had to keep to that. They had to be consistent. Because when they show that they're not consistent in what they're doing, this is one of the reasons why they were constantly driving and creating the controls and the unconstitutional controls and regulations over the Department of Transportation and over our infrastructure. All of this was all the plan. They had every intention of assuming and usurping power from the states. They didn't see the state legislatures per se to be the real problem, because every time the federal government did something and they handed them money to start executing regulations regarding labor and establishing a minimum wage, the states just jumped on board because they were getting paid to do it, and it was giving them more control over their people. You know, power is a very evil thing, because when you start assuming power, the Milgram experiment is pretty interesting. But anyway, if you've ever seen that. But my point is that what we're seeing here is that the federal court's job is very specific. That if they're going to get involved in a case between courts, like land grants, those types of things, land disputes, yeah, they have jurisdiction under that or over that. But they do not have jurisdiction over just anything and everything, because one state doesn't like what another state's doing. California doesn't like the smog that's coming out of the cars out of Detroit, Michigan. Tough. The federal courts have nothing. That does not fall under the jurisdiction of the federal government until you actually amend the Constitution to give them that control. And thank God they didn't ever did this, because they've created this monstrosity of usurpations, it allows us to undo this and actually move forward where we actually have control over it by doing it right. Because the federal government was never about doing things right. It was about obtaining control and then moving us in the direction they needed to move us, because as they started taking over corporations in the 1800s to start creating global corporations, America had no, the United States didn't have any global corporations. In the early 1820s or whatever that was, when DuPont was, you know, taking on the Germans in the international market, that was a corporation of a state. That was not the United States. It was a corporation coming out of the union of the states, but it was a state corporation. So the federal government needed to take control, because then they could actually create a level playing field and giving the corporations a better advantage and be able to start competing globally to become global giants in their environment, in their market space. Which is one of the reasons why, if you ever watch, you know, the world's largest corporations and so forth, America dominates in so many different ways, even in technology. And, you know, we're not that big. Why is it, and how is it that we're dominating in that way? Because it was done by the federal government, and the federal government actually set the stage to be able to do that. And I, with the help of Britain and so forth, I digress. We've got basically a minute left. So what do you think, or any comments you have on, you know, what we're talking about as far as the courts and how America has, you know, basically been, I'll just say, consumed into this globalist agenda, and the courts were the huge drivers for this.
Oh, I totally agree with that. Their usurpation of the interpretation of the laws, mm-hmm, has allowed all of this globalist and corporate capture of the government to occur, because the Congress wouldn't be, shall we say, compromised, mm-hmm, and they'd be able to get things done that the American people need done if they weren't beholden to these corporations.
Right. And so as the plan unfolded, they created a very, very intricate webbing to make it so hard to see through. I mean, it's like the densest of forests, where not even the daylight, I don't know if you've ever been in a forest, where you couldn't tell what time of day it was. You knew the sun was
in the Black Forest in Germany.
Yeah, there you go.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and in the rainforest in Washington State, I've seen it like that, where you couldn't tell what time of day it is because of the triple canopies, you know. And there's places in the world where it's like that, and you go, oh, my gosh. That is the webbing of all of the controls, the webbing of, you know, all of these things that they've assumed control of. It's not, this is not legitimate. We've never granted all of this webbing to be created. This is what they just started doing in front of us because nobody challenged it, because the courts blessed it. So I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.